All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. A quick heads up, the first hour today is going to be with Pittsburgh Power. I will answer some other questions if we need to. The second hour is going to be Destination Health. Right now, questions are really light. This normally happens at the beginning of the show, and then by the end of the show, I can't get to all the questions. So if you want to get in with a question, specifically right now for Pittsburgh Power, Destination Health in the next hour, now is your chance. If you press 1 on your phone right now with a question, a comment, a topic, anything you want to talk about, I guarantee we'll get to you. But the questions are starting to come in pretty heavy right now. So let's go ahead and get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it, we'll tackle it here on this show. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. Today is the Power Hour. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power, Pete and Ethan. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Hi, Kevin.
Kevin.
Great to have you here. So we're looking forward to it. We have a lot of questions on hold. But before we get to the questions, anything you guys want to start with today?
One interesting thing we saw, and this is actually kind of rare, but a first actually. We had a truck come into the shop where none of the sensors were reading to the ECM. And it turned out that somebody had accidentally shorted the return to the ECM, and it damaged the ECM internally. But we were able to fix that one. We ran a new trace inside.
Wow. That's interesting.
The truck didn't, it
doing
didn't run very well.
Stuff, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It didn't sound quite right either.
Yeah. Interesting. So I guess I never thought about that, but there are a lot of sensors. And depending on the truck and the model and the year, there can really be a lot of sensors. But they're all coming back through one channel, the ECM.
Some of them have two, but most of the time it is one or two channels, yes.
Wow. Well, I guess that makes sense. I just never thought about it. And if something did happen to that, that would really cause some problems.
Oh, yeah. It can cause multiple sensors to fail simultaneously. And at that point, it's not a sensor issue. It's a wiring or ECM issue.
Got it. Okay. So now you guys actually repaired the ECM internally. My guess is there's probably not another shop in the country that would have done it that way. They would have just replaced the ECM, right?
Yeah, most likely. It happened. We took off the ECM, put it on the tester, and saw that, you know, nothing was working on the tester either. And at that point, we, you know, opened it up, and Leroy was able to find where, you know, the trace was broken there on the ECM.
Interesting. So just so people know, because I'm not sure a lot of people realize this, the ECM is a computer. You know, not all that different from a computer sitting on your desk or doing any other thing. But, you know, I used to build computers back in the late 80s when, you know, nobody really knew what they were. And, you know, it looks complicated until you break things down by the components. And then you would know, okay, here, this component goes here. And so that's really what's happening in an ECM. You've got components, motherboards, all kinds of other things in there. But the industry has always treated it like, there it is, it's an ECM. It either works or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, they tend to just replace it, which is pretty expensive. You guys have actually developed tools and methods of fixing these things, right?
Absolutely there. There's always things that, you know, can't be fixed. The one ECM came in, it was flooded full of fuel for too long. Once it starts to break down, you know, large portions of the ECM, then there's not much you can do for it there. But, you know, minor breaks in there can, you know, be repaired normally.
Excellent. Well, that is a different one. What do you say we get to some phone calls?
Sounds good.
All right, let's do it. Let's start off in West Virginia. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Morning.
Whatever. I've got an 07 Century 14-liter EGR D-Deck 5. I had a head gasket leaking. It was pushing compression into the cooling system. And up until last Monday, we were still wondering maybe it could be the compressor, maybe EGR cooler. Well, the head gasket let go on me in Chillicothe, Ohio. I made it into Dayton. And I dropped my trailer. I parked the truck. They came out an hour later to try to start it, and it was locked up. The cylinder was full of water. So they tore it down and sent me pictures and showed me cavitation between, on top of the block, between the cylinder bores, that the liners were out of tolerance. So everything's got to be counterbored and new liners. They quoted me a new head, new EGR, new rocker assembly. The total estimate came in just north of $24,000, including all the core charges. So I'm sure some of that will come off. Here I am. I owe $6,000 on probably a $20,000 truck. It's got 855,000 miles on it. It appears I do have the ability to get some money and some financing to get the truck fixed. But I just wanted to throw it at you guys, let you ask me some questions and make sure that I know what I know. And cause I'm wanting to reuse the head and they don't want to, they want to put a new head on it. So, I'll let you guys ask whatever you need to ask and help me get a handle on the situation.
Okay. Well, as far as the cylinder head goes, if you had 400,000 or 500,000 miles on it, I wouldn't have a problem reusing it. But 850 and above, I mean, you're towards its life cycle anyhow. If you would reuse it and say you drop a valve, you don't have any warranty. If you would have oil consumption, again, because of the head, no warranty. So I would replace it. I agree with them wanting to replace the cylinder head. I think it'd be money well spent.
Well, is there any safety or danger in trying to inspect and reuse the rocker assembly? Or if we're going that far, just go that far.
No, I mean, we only replace them if it's bad. I mean, they check the levers, are they worn, are the shafts worn. I mean, if they're in spec, there's no problem reusing them. Okay. As they slowly wear, what you would find, it won't hold an overhead, but that's easy enough to change down the road. But that's one of the things, they would have to inspect it, and if it's good, reuse it. If it's bad, I wouldn't replace it just for the sake of replacing it like I would the cylinder head.
Okay. I guess it's supposed to have new cups in it. And they said they will reuse my injectors. Up until the breakdown, the truck had a 7.5 90-day average. So everything was working right, you know, until then. So are you comfortable reusing those injectors? Is that another thing? Again, we can come back later and put a six-pack in if necessary.
That is correct. Yep. Again, it's okay. Easy enough to do. You know, a set of injectors, you know, 5-6 hour job versus, you know, a cylinder head, which could also cause progressive damage. You normally don't have that. If, say, an injector acts up, you're going to have a misfire or smoke. And it's easy enough to replace that injector or the set.
Okay, one more question. Tell me what a new EGR cooler and new oil cooler would be, and if it would be less than what I would receive back from the cores. I'm thinking, well, to keep from having to drain the whole thing down again to replace those things, would I be good to go ahead and do those while the thing is apart?
You know, if you're not having any problems, I'm not sure if there's a need to change it.
Okay, not any that I know of.
Yeah.
I went in there thinking, oh, I got a head gasket blown. This will be $3,500 to $5,000, and I got that estimate. They about had to pick me up out of the floor. So,
yeah, a lot of times
I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on it now.
Yeah, a lot of times that happens. You know, when you have a head gasket blown, and the mileage is high, the liner protrusion is low anyhow, and the only fix is to pull the liners and do the counter bores. Well, if you're going to do that, you might as well throw, you know, a set of cylinder kits in there.
Right. Kevin, with a, you know, this truck's probably worth about 20 grand, I'd say, 06 on it. I'm doing the math and thinking, well, if I put, you know, 20 or 25 grand in this motor, you know, this is a good truck. I've run it for 2 years with very, very little problems. You know, I'm trying to think, do I sink that much money into this particular unit or getting something else that has a lot more unknowns than my truck does?
You know, in this case, based on what you said, it's a good truck. Fuel mileage has been good. You haven't had a lot of problems with it, and it's a known quantity. You know the truck. We know what you're going to have when you're done. This is one of those cases where I would say keep what you've got and put the money into it.
Okay. Awesome, guys. Appreciate all your help. Everybody have a happy new year. We'll talk to you next
You're
time.
Welcome. Happy new year. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
The call. Let's see. We're coming up on a break. So we'll take us into the break here. When we come back, we'll get to more of your calls and questions. Pete, what's the phone number and the website over there? Because I know we always get a lot of people who can't get through here on the air, and how can they get a hold of you?
Okay, the phone number is 724-360-4080, and the website is pittsburghpower.com.
Excellent. All right, stick around. We will be right back with more stuff right after this break. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back to the Power Hour. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power, Pete and Ethan, and we're taking your calls and answering your questions about engines, maintenance, troubleshooting, electronics, you name it. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. We're going to head off to Arizona. Kevin, welcome to the program.
How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Okay. First of all, the first caller, I have the same truck. I had the same dilemma, and I actually rebuilt my motor, and I'm glad I did. And
Good.
Don't forget to do the bowl gear while you're doing it.
D-Deck 5 doesn't have bowl gears.
What was that?
D-Deck 5 doesn't have a bowl gear like the 3s and 4s.
Okay.
I mean, there's a gear on the cam, but it's not a bowl gear that's a known problem like the 3s and 4s have.
Okay. And my other thing is, there's a rumor going around on the road, and you always love the rumors, that diesel exhaust fluid is on the way out. Is that true? And if so, what are they going to replace it with? What crap will you come up with next?
Here's one of the things that I really like to do when people say things like this. Anytime somebody says something like this, no matter where I am, I'll look at them and I'll say, really, why or how? See if they know what they're talking about or if they're just repeating something they heard somewhere else. I do a ton of reading every day on the industry. I haven't seen anything new that would be replacing diesel exhaust fluid anytime soon. You're looking at an entire redesign of the emission system. Now, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a company that claimed they could do this with diesel fuel instead of diesel exhaust fluid, but the technology never made it to an engine that I'm aware of anywhere. Pete, do you guys know of anything?
No, I haven't heard anything. That's the first I've heard of this.
Yeah,
I didn't think so. I was looking at the guy like he had a third head, but
you know, there's lots of technologies that are being explored. There are different types of fuels that are being explored. You know, natural gas, there's dimethyl ether. Now I just read something the other day about a synthetic diesel fuel. All of these alternative fuels are supposed to help with emissions, but that nothing has been very clear about what that means. First off, we're never going to move to those fuels until they are cheaper than diesel. Everything happens because of money, and we either money or the government mandates it. And I don't see that happening on any new fuel right now either. So those fuels are either going to have to get cheaper, or they're going to have to save us enough money somewhere. But there's nothing in the works that I can see anywhere that's going to get rid of diesel exhaust fluid anytime soon.
Okay, thanks. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. We're going to sneak in a text question here. We're going to head off to Florida. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hey again, Kevin. Thanks for taking the call. Hey, we don't have a business dedicated cell phone yet, so we're using our personal phones and our personal iPads for making phone calls, sending text updates, getting emails, looking for loads. We've got the service on the account plus installment payments for all four devices. Is there a portion of that that we can still deduct on our taxes?
You know, this is actually
to some extent it's used personally.
Yeah, this is actually one of the areas in the tax code that the last couple of years is just kind of driving me nuts. The IRS doesn't seem to want to make up its mind on this. And when they do make up their mind, I just don't like their answer at all. They've made some statements and put some things into effect that says if you have a plan and it includes minutes, that they don't want this to be tax deductible because they think there's no way to separate the personal minutes from the business, and you're deducting them all no matter how you're using them. My argument has always been, if I own a business, I need the phone, especially an owner-operator who's on the road all the time. It's not like they're sitting in an office with another phone. So my take has always been, we deduct the entire cost of the plan, everything. We'll fight with them later. Now, depending on who you have do your tax return, I would go over it with them and have them explain what their take is on this. But
okay,
the IRS has just been kind of back and forth on this and not really clear. So I'm just going to keep taking the deduction.
Okay, excellent. As always, thank you. And I'll try to catch you guys on Destination Health.
Sounds great. Let's go to North Dakota. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Well, yesterday, coming up from Missouri with the load, all of a sudden my truck started losing power and throwing codes in my scan gauge. Had an uncle with a shop up in St. Paul. I was on my way up north. Stopped in there. And the only thing they could come up with was it was throwing a intake valve actuator code and a turbo code. What I've got is an 05 Columbia, the XS Cat, and I really don't know where to go from there. We had it in the shop, and they replaced the intake valve actuator, and I left there about 5 minutes after I left, and I'm throwing the same codes again.
Guys, any ideas here?
Yeah, we actually I've seen this similar problem. The truck is currently in a D-rate. Anytime it thinks there's an issue with the intake valve actuator or any of that system there, it will cut the power on the truck. Again, there's multiple actuators on the top of that engine. So it could be more than one that failed, or the wrong one was replaced. There is a test that they can run and it's an automated test, and it's best done outside. It causes the truck to smoke a little while this test is going on, and it will determine which actuator is bad. Normally, you know, most shops would have the CAT software to do it, or a CAT dealer.
Okay. Yeah, we had it on a CAT computer, you know, at that shop. It was, you know, an independent shop, but, you know,
yeah,
like I say, that I leave, and I'm still down. It feels like I'm down about 150 horsepower from what I'm supposed to have. But turbo only spools up to about 35 versus the 50 to 55 I normally get.
Yeah, and that sounds about right there, because we had one on the dyno, and it was a 550, you know, factory rating there, and it was only putting, it was in the 400s at that point, like 430, when it had this code going on. So, yeah, that sounds about right there. You're going to lose about 100, 150 horsepower. Ironically, the test, the name of it is called an intake valve actuator test, and what it does is it'll turn the actuators on and off and try to determine which one is bad. But at the very end of the test, it'll smoke out a shop if you're indoors.
All right. Would an intake actuator, would that cause it to throw a turbo code also? Or is that totally a separate issue?
It sounds like that would be a separate issue there.
I mean, because they both popped up at, like, within a minute of each other, which is what really concerns me, you know. I don't see why they would both fail just like that. I mean, it can happen, but I just think the possibilities of it are kind of rare. They have two separate failures just like that.
Yeah. What do you know exactly what the code was on the turbo?
The scan gauge code, you know, the flash code on the scan gauge is a 33 and a 21.
Yeah, I'd have to look that up to see what that looks up there in, you know, on the CAT.
As far as looking it up on anything I can find for CAT, that, you know, the CAT skips them numbers. I can't find it in anything online or even in the book in the shop where I was at. They didn't have anything for them codes.
Yeah, if they had, you know, the CAT electronic service technician there, it should actually diagnose. It'll give them that same number, and it'll give them a description of what it, you know, what the code means.
Okay. All right. Now, if it is, say it's a turbo wastegate on these twin turbo motors, can a guy just replace the wastegate on these, or do you have to replace the whole both turbos?
I'm fairly certain you can get the wastegate there. I mean, I think we've done that a couple times here.
I have a friend with a C12, and he had, you know, he was throwing a similar code, I believe. I'm trying to remember back and what code it was, and, you know, it was a wastegate issue, and they told him he was lucky because he had one of the very few that you could replace a wastegate on.
And it depends how it failed. The one time when we found one that was stuck, it had seized internally, and at that point you need a turbo there.
Okay.
And also another option would be, like, at our shop here, if I had a bad turbo, say the wheel was damaged or something, but the actuator is good, we'd swap them out for a customer. Because sometimes CAT does control that, where they won't let you buy that part. And what they're claiming is that's part of the emissions. So they won't sell it. You got to buy the whole turbo. So sometimes that is the case. Basically, call CAT with your serial number and see if you can purchase it.
Okay.
All right. Good stuff. We've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. You're listening to the Power Hour. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power, Pete and Ethan. Hey, guys, you know, I've been through a lot of the engine manuals, and it seems to me like in most cases, the OEM has created some pretty clear procedures to troubleshoot and test for certain things, and this seems like a good example. And I don't mean to keep bashing other shops, but it seems like a lot of these shops just ignore the fact that there's a procedure and they just start throwing parts at things. It sounds like that was the case here, that there is a method to figure out which actuator it is. Don't just start replacing an actuator.
That's pretty common, I think. And even with a code, there's a flow chart of, okay, it's code 123. Check pin A to pin B. It should be 5 volts. It is. Okay, then go to part 2, which is check the ohms on pin A to pin C or whatever. There's a procedure to do. At that point, it normally puts you in a direction you need to go in. I think a lot of shops don't take the time to do that.
Yeah, that's surely, you know, what it seems to me. I you know, years ago when I first started getting a lot of these emission problems and these codes, and I went to do some research to figure it out, and I would say, well, this is exactly what the guy said was happening, and yet the shop didn't do this. Like you said, it was a flow chart. Do this, mm-hmm. then this, then that. And it seemed really clear, like, you know, they've put a lot of time and effort into developing these, and shops just ignore them and throw parts at things.
Yeah, that's pretty common. And back to that ECM, we'll repair them where a shop will simply replace it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, one, it's expensive. Two, it's frustrating. Here, mm-hmm. here was a problem that it sounds like, with a little bit of work following the flow chart, going through this test that Ethan just described, it sounds like most of the time we'd be able to identify which actuator, replace it, and the problem should go away. Instead, it sounds like they saw actuator, replaced an actuator, but probably got the wrong one.
And yes, I've seen that happen before there.
Yeah, well, it's frustrating. You know, I tell people all the time, I wish I had better answers. I don't know why you can't get your truck fixed. But part of the reason they can't get their truck fixed is because shops won't follow the procedures that have been developed.
And I think a shop that is on a flat rate is even worse, because that tech knows he's got to get that in and out or he's not getting paid. So he's going to do whatever he can to be within time to make sure his paycheck's okay. Unfortunately, that's at the expense of the driver. But I think it's a problem with flat rate. We're by the hour here.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about that. That's interesting, because I used to manage body shops, and they are almost all flat rate. The difference, though, that I think that happens a lot, is in the body shop, if I knew I've only got 11 hours to get this job done, and I take 15, I'm still only going to get paid for 11. If I can do it mm-hmm. in 9, I still get paid for 11. But mm-hmm. you were careful not to shortcut the process, because if something went wrong, it came back on you, and now you had to redo it, and you didn't get paid anything. But I mm-hmm. think what the mentality in truck shops might be, you know, once I get this thing out the door, the guy's 200 miles down the road, it's going somewhere else. So
exactly.
let's just get this thing out of here. I'll get paid. I'll move on to the next job. Let the driver deal with it later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's sad. That's sad. That's why I tell people just to come to you guys and skip dealing with that. Let's go to another call. We're off to New York. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Week several times. Thankfully, you've been a world of help. I've got a question for Pete and Ethan, maybe, and for you too. I'd heard a previous show talked about setting aside $18,000 to $22,000 for an in-frame. I think they were referring to like a 60 series Detroit. I'm the guy that runs the straight box trucks with the Caterpillar 10s. So getting to my point, my question is, what should I set aside for a C10 rebuild with all the bells and whistles from Pittsburgh Power?
Well, a basic in-frame on a C15, I don't do too many C10s or 12s. Mostly we see a C15, but minimum's 18 grand. And that's a basic in-frame from us would be the cylinder head, the injectors, your cylinder kits, your bearings, water pump, lube pump, gaskets, and fluids, and a dyno runs about 18.5. If
okay.
you need a turbo, you know, that would be extra. If you need the oil cooler, that might add 1,000. So it can go up from there.
Okay. And I have three of these trucks now, the Freightliner Century class, and I'm in the process of buying a fourth one because I'm getting it so cheap. I'm only paying like $4,500 for this truck. But the
wow.
manufacturing, yeah, my question is the difference between like ECMs. I've got I'm in a 2000 right now that was manufactured March of 2000. The one I'm picking up for $4,500 was manufactured in August of 99. Is there a great difference in the ECM, Kevin? Is there a big difference between these trucks? And I guess, what I'm really after is to my understanding, you had said that, if I understood it correctly, and I apologize if I didn't, but that the 2000 is the cutoff on these EOBR mandates.
Okay, so a couple
questions. Sorry.
No, that's okay. The difference in the ECM on a C10, I wouldn't have a clue when they changed or model numbers or anything. You guys may know that one. I can answer the question on the EOBR, sort of, because they haven't clarified yet whether they're going to use model year or manufactured date. And that's kind of, or if they have clarified it, I haven't seen it yet. What all they've said is that EOBRs will not be required on 99s and older, but they haven't clarified, you know, those couple of trucks that might be in between. Is it the model year on the title, or is it the manufactured date that's going to determine this? And I don't know the answer to that yet.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Kevin. And would Pete and Ethan know about the ECM difference between a 99 and a 2000?
On the ECM, you're going to want to look at the first three digits of the serial number on that CAT. If they're the same, then the ECM is definitely, you know, the same ECM, and you'd even be
okay.
able to switch them in and out there. If they're
okay.
not the same, then if the serial number, the first three digits aren't the same, then there's still a chance it could be. On them, it's likely to have one like a 70 pin type ECM on there. So you'll
okay.
if they both look like the same ECM at that point, then yeah, they're going to be real similar.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I appreciate you as always.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Texas. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Kevin. Hi, Pete. Hi, Ethan. How are we doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good. Hey, Pete, Ethan, you've worked on my truck before. I had it up there. I've got a 12.7, and I've done great things with it. This year, because of your help, I got 9.06 miles per gallon on a flatbed, so I'm extremely happy.
Fantastic.
Future question down the road, 5 years, you know, looking at planning maybe a little bit, but what would you say would be the loss of power or better miles per gallon if I were to go to 11-liter Detroit than the 12.7 in a DDAC 4, or make it a DDAC 4 if I had an older 11-liter. And also, the increase in power, less miles per gallon if I were to go to the 14-liter DDAC 4.
Well, as far as the – what kind of weight do you gross most of the time? Or are you all
well,
on scale?
It's for 9 months, I was at 8,000 pounds on a flatbed. That's why I got so good.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all good things then, it seems like. So now I'm back to, you know, on the low side, 50,000 pounds gross to, you know, 80,000 pounds gross. So when I would get general freight, I got 7.24 in the winter for 4 months. And I'm over 8 now with general freight, 8.2 right now. But I don't think the 8,000-pound freight is really going to – it may come back, it may not. I don't know. So
the only problem I have with the 11 liter engine would be when you are heavy, you're going to be working it much harder.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it would justify the expense to change to 11-liter engine, especially with the fuel mileage you're getting.
Pete, hold that thought. We're going to get to a break. We're going to come back to this, though, so stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the final segment of the first hour. We're going to get to as many maintenance and engine calls here as we can. And then at the end, I'll say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff I say at the end of a show. But don't hang up because we're going to come back and record an hour of Destination Health. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power, Ethan, and we're going to get back to the calls. Before we get back to the call, though, Pete, why don't you give them the phone number? I know there were a lot of questions we didn't get to today, so if they need to talk to you off the air, how do they get a hold of you?
Okay, our phone number is 724-360-4080.
Excellent. Let's. We're going to go back to Ken. We were talking about the differences between the 12.7, the 11.1, and the non-EGR 14-liter. Ken, go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, sometimes I'd like to get better fuel mileage, you know, and I'm thinking about what I'm specializing in right then, light freight, you know, and trying to squeak out a little bit more, but I wouldn't change to what I got from a 12.7 till it's wore out. And then the other aspect is I like power, but on my engine, the 12.7 that Pete and Ethan have worked on, I've got two power settings, the 642 horsepower at 2019 foot-pounds of torque, but I don't run it there much at all. Usually it's on the 462 horsepower to the ground. So, but thinking of brainstorming kind of with the different sizes of engines.
Yeah, you know, I love the 11-liter. It's just I don't do a whole lot with it anymore. There just aren't enough of them around, I think, to get real excited about it. Pete, I don't know how much time you guys have looked at the 11-liter, what would be the potential, do you think, as far as horsepower and torque out of that engine?
We haven't seen many of them, but I'm sure, you know, they could safely handle probably another 100 horsepower, 200, 225 foot-pounds of torque on top of whatever they're rated at. But I don't know what their ratings are. We just don't see them.
The ratings when I had them early on, like early 90s is when I started buying them. Most of them were set at 350 horse. You could also set them at 370, and I'm pretty sure there was a setting for 430. And
that was
about, yeah. So
DDEC 2 then, huh? That would have been a DDEC 2.
Yep, okay. DDEC 2s. Now, in 95... when I was buying a new truck and I went to spec an 11.1, they told me I couldn't get it. But I do know there were some fleets that were still building 11.1s into the late 90s. And I don't know how that worked. I couldn't order one, but I know they were being built. You know, my thought always was if we could get this engine to, say, 500 horse, 1,700 or 1,800 foot-pounds of torque, I think it would be an ideal engine.
Yeah, I don't think that'd be a problem.
No, that should be safely done there. You know, you always want to put them on the dyno there to dial them in real nice. But if you get, you know, anywhere from that 1650 to 17 foot-pounds at the rear wheels, you know, about that, it would be a good little truck there.
Yeah, and, you know, and I'd still like to do this. Like I say, there's just not enough 11 ones around that I don't know that it would be worth proving anything anymore. But I've thought about building a single axle tractor with an 11-1, building the tractor as light as I could possibly get it, matching it to a spread axle trailer, and I would be able to scale the same weight on four axles that everybody else does on five. And there would be a lot of advantages to that. And then I would just look for really light freight anyway. But I think you could build a 10-mile-per-gallon combination that way.
Yeah, it definitely would have a chance with an engine and setup like that, that's for sure.
Yeah, so who knows? Maybe we'll get around to it. But right now, let's try to get around to a couple more phone calls here. Let's go to Texas. David, welcome to the program.
The guy was talking about the head earlier. I don't know if he was doing an in-frame. I didn't catch the whole conversation, but when I bring my truck in and I'm looking for an in-frame, from the oil system to the head, what kind of stuff can I expect? You know, bearing, finery, pistons, are they going to do connecting rods?
That would depend on the shop. What I consider an in-frame and someone else considers an in-frame could be two different things. Generally, when we do an in-frame, it's cylinder head, it's injectors, your cylinder kits, your connecting rods, your bearings, your gaskets, your fluids and labor. You would have to go over with the shop and say, okay, exactly what am I getting? Some guys don't replace the connecting rods. Some of them won't replace the injectors. And that's where you get difference in prices.
Okay. So you do connecting rods. What kind of criteria are you looking at to reuse the connecting rods? I mean, I bought a core motor, and so I got a set of connecting rods. I got a crank. I got a new bull gear. Motor only had 125,000 miles on it when the truck burned down. So
in that case,
oil pump. Oil pressure regulator. Do you guys that stuff, or is that good for indefinitely?
Okay. Well, as far as the connecting rods, in your case, I would probably send them to a local machine shop, and they can spec them out, make sure they're straight, they magnaflex them for cracks, put new bushings in them. As far as the lube pump, if there's a lot of miles and you don't know the history, it would be a good idea just to put a lube pump on it. I don't think they're terribly expensive, $500 or $600 for a lube pump. On a Detroit. They're not too bad.
Okay. Cool. All right. Yeah, so I got all my parts and I'm ready to go. The DDEC 4 that I'm running right now has got 1,351,000 miles on it. Now, when I put fresh oil in it, I'm using Rotelateam. I go about 12,000 miles before I got to add a gallon. But after that first gallon, then I start, once I get above 20,000 miles or so, I'm dumping a gallon about every 5,000 miles.
Well, that's still really that's really good, but you're getting consumption now because the oil is getting dirty.
Okay.
Now put an OPS-1 on there, a bypass oil filtration system, and that'll help that a little bit.
Yeah, I did that.
All right, good stuff. At 1.3 million, that still sounds like a fairly strong engine, and sounds like there's some life left in there as well. Let's squeeze another call in here. Let's go to New York City. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, guys. How you doing today?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm doing good. Hey, I am considering purchasing a truck, and the gentleman had said that he had a bunch of work done at your shop. And what I wanted to know is if I gave you guys the VIN, would I be able to confirm that he actually had the things that he said done at the shop? He's asking a premium for the truck, And I don't necessarily mind paying a bit of a premium, considering it's got a lot of Pittsburgh Power parts on it. But I want to confirm that the premium is worth it.
Okay. The only way we can look up something through our system is through his name. So if we'd find out what his name is, we could look up it. Like the VIN number, I don't store that in my computer. It's on the work order, but there'd be no way of me looking it up other than through his name.
Okay, so it's possible that even if we look it up through his name, that work was done on a different truck.
It could be that, or sometimes a guy will use a company name versus his personal name, or they use, you know, it's sometimes hard to find, but we can look it up for you. You know, call after the show and I'll look it up.
Okay. I'll see if I can find out from him how he had it written up at your shop.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Good stuff. I'm looking at the clock, and guys, I think we just blew right through this hour. It always goes so fast. We have so many questions. Before we wrap this up, Pete, why don't you give them the phone number again? If they have any questions, they can get a hold of you off the air.
Okay. The phone number is 724-360-4080.
Excellent. Great stuff. As always, thank you guys. I learned something every time we do the show. I'm sure the listeners are learning, and we really appreciate you guys taking the time and helping us out.
Thanks for having us, Kevin.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
All right. Great stuff. That was Pete and Ethan from Pittsburgh Power. We will never get to all the engine related questions we have. I appreciate everybody calling in. It's only an hour a week. We are going to expand on that, but you can always call Pittsburgh Power off the air. Again, 724-360-4080. They really do things different. It's not just a bunch of guys throwing parts and trying to get you out the door. They're going to work with you. They're going to troubleshoot things correctly. And if they can repair an ECM rather than replace it, they will. I just don't see that happening anywhere else, and that can save you lots of money and time and headache. So check it out. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, everybody, give me just a minute here. We are getting set up for the Destination Health Hour. We've got some questions lined up right now, but we might be able to sneak in some more. If you've got a question about health, nutrition, diet, disease, exercise, fitness, whatever it might be, this is your chance. Press 1 on your phone, and we will get to you. Give me just a minute. We're switching shows. All right, here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to our world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Joining me today, my co-host, Kim Cockerham. This is the show where we talk about everything health, destination health. We're going to talk about fitness, diet, nutrition, exercise, disease, drugs, doctors, you name it. We'll tackle it here on the air. All you have to do is pick up the phone and call me, and we're excited to be back here for another hour. Kim, welcome back.
Hi, so glad to be here. How are you?
Doing wonderful. So how are the holidays treating you so far?
Good. We're actually back in Ohio, and it's been a pleasure being back here. The weather's mild. We got to get up and do some really good runs. My eating hasn't been spot on, so I cannot wait till get back into my environment, just like I'm sure so many of our drivers experience too, you know, just when you're not in your normal routine, how easy you can sabotage yourself.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, I think what everybody struggles with this time of year. There's parties, there's get-togethers, there's lots and lots of different foods, usually not, you know, along the health food line. But you know what? I just don't think it's that big of a deal if this is the time of year where you fall off the wagon once in a while and you don't eat quite that healthy. You know, it's not a big deal. Enjoy it. Don't feel guilty about it. And then pick your day and just get back to it. There's nothing wrong with that happening. Yeah. Just don't beat
yourself up. And that's what I love in how you brought it to everybody too. This isn't a diet. It's a lifestyle. So it's not a beginning and an ending.
Yeah, it really isn't. And a lifestyle should have some room for things that you enjoy and not get so stressed out about it. Just be careful not to make it a habit. You
know, exactly.
If during the holidays somebody is always baking something and you're eating a lot of dessert, enjoy it. You know, do it, enjoy it. Don't feel guilty about it, but keep it in the back of your mind that you're not going to make this a habit. This is a special occasion or occasions, you know, throughout the whole holidays. And then just set a clear date when you say, okay, holidays are over. We're going to get back to what's good for us.
Yeah. And it's good. And choose it. Be mindful. We talk about that a lot, being mindful. So, and being aware, I'll tell you what, I don't like how I feel. So I'm ready to reel it back in for sure.
Well, and you know, there's another tip when you're doing this. First of all, choose to do it. You know, be conscious of what you're choosing. Make sure it doesn't become a habit. Enjoy it. If you're going to do it, enjoy it. But also, if you do it and you don't feel good, pay attention to that. That's a good sign, and it can be a good motivator to keep you on track the rest of the time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, for me, the holidays this year were a little different because I have played around and experimented, you know, with, you know, more sugar, higher carbs here and there, and I immediately feel the difference. I know that I'm not going to feel good. So this year, even though a lot of people around me and, you know, places I go and there's food and it's not always the best food, this year I just wasn't tempted. And it felt good.
It was great.
I would look at it and say, my God, I know that would taste good, but the taste is going to last 30 seconds and the side effects are going to last 12 hours. You know, I'm not going to.
Exactly.
And sometimes looking at it that way, and I didn't feel like I was depriving myself. If I really felt like that, I would have just eaten it and dealt with it. But it was a conscious choice to look at it and say, I know it's going to taste good, but I also know how I'm going to feel, and it's just not a good trade-off for me anymore.
Right. That's a good place to be.
Yeah. A couple other things we noticed. You sent me a link, or I sent you a link. I don't remember which one, but we were talking about it. The more and more endurance athletes who are becoming fat-adapted. There are more and more stories in. A while back, I talked about the 12-hour run, the record being held by a fairly young American guy, Zach Bitters, and it looks like he just broke his record again, and he is fully fat-adapted when he runs. Pretty amazing.
It's really amazing, and to think, and that's on a track, 24 hours around a track, and He beat his PR by just under 7 minutes, which when you stretch that out over a 24-hour time frame, what that means, you know, how he had to keep going, and it's incredible.
Yeah. So I love seeing this. We're seeing entire teams now, trainers who are moving entire teams to more of a high-fat low carb diet, getting them into that fat burning mode. And now the more science I see, the more I read of this, the more it makes total sense. You know, we wouldn't want to drive a truck that we had to refuel every 20 minutes. We would much rather drive a truck that we could go 12 hours without refueling. And that's kind of what the body does. When we are sugar burners, which most people are, and you go to do a high-intensity sport, you know this. You've been through it. You have to refuel constantly.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, and as I'm, like you said, I'm glad a lot of the sporting world, and it's very small part of it that's latching onto this, but because marketing against it is so crazy, you know, with Gatorade and gels and power and thing is pretty intense, but it's amazing how new it is that we have become so dependent on the sugary stuff and how we had trained our body to require the sugary stuff. And, you know, it can make or break people's races and get them to stop completely is what's unfortunately happening too, you know, because the body just does not do well on sugar for a long period of time.
Well, the other thing that I think is interesting is if you look at standard advice, the advice was don't worry about all the carbohydrates because you're exercising so much, it won't matter. Well, it turns out that's not true. A lot of these athletes are showing up as pre-diabetic and you exercise any more than these people do. I mean, that's their life. And what they're finding is they were not able to out-exercise a bad diet. And that bad diet was just too many carbohydrates. So it's interesting. I love seeing some of those stories. A couple other things. We have had a case, maybe even two now, of people who have switched to the low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diet. And at some point, their cholesterol numbers have gone off the charts, which is not common and it's not normal. The common response to a low-carb, high-fat diet is all of the cholesterol markers improve. As long as we ignore total cholesterol, because that's a meaningless number anyway. But if we look at the real markers, the ratios, the LDL, the what happens with triglycerides and HDL, all the markers are good. That's been proven over and over and over again. But there seems to be a case where, and it's rare, so far what I've read is it's about 1 or 2% of the population, and it's genetic, where when they go on a high-fat diet, they end up with off-the-chart cholesterol numbers, over 400. You know, just crazy high numbers. There isn't a lot of research as to what that means. Will that lead to heart disease? You know, most of the researchers and doctors that I've read from are being cautious. And they are saying, look, we don't know what numbers like that are going to do. So they're working to back those numbers off. And without scrapping the whole diet, you don't want to do that because if you go back to the standard American diet, we know you're going to have problems. So it's kind of a challenge right now to work through this with these people, and some of the recommendations have been cut back on some of the saturated fat in your diet. If you're eating the bullet or drinking the bulletproof coffee, stop, because the both types of fat that you're putting in the bulletproof coffee are saturated. So they're saying you can stick with a high fat diet, just start getting a better balance, more unsaturated. So you would be looking at olive oil, avocado oil, and it doesn't have to be completely unsaturated, but just start shifting the balance. Those are some of the things I've seen. Certainly work with a doctor and keep an eye on the numbers. And also start adding more good quality carbohydrates back into the diet. Now, I'm going to come back and clarify that just a little bit. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Joining me, my co-host Kim Cockerham. So, Kim, I sent you over an article about this, and it's by one of the doctors that I really respect, and he's been doing the low-carb, high-fat thing for a long time. Can we get that article posted up on the Destination Health Facebook page?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like I say, it's pretty rare. They claim about 1% or 2% of the population will have this happen, but we've had a couple callers. So I went looking and I found this article, and it kind of should take away a lot of the worry. You know, it's not something to get too crazy about, but you might want to tweak the diet. Cut back a little bit on the saturated fat. Don't go low fat, though. Stay, you know, predominantly fat burning. Go to some more unsaturated fats and add more good carbohydrates back into the diet, and then see what happens with the numbers.
Yeah, and you know, JR, I love that you specifically, he was one of them that came on board with us about that, and he was such a great example of somebody who tracked his numbers, his cholesterol, and would try the diet and then retrack again and adjust and track again. And to me, that's the name of the game, because it is so individual for all of us, how our body adjusts to this.
Absolutely. And the other thing that, you know, I've certainly done and I encourage other people to do, traditionally the Atkins diet, which has been by far the most popular of the low carbohydrate diets, traditionally it's been thought of as a high protein diet. And people, there's this image of everybody eating bacon and butter and eggs on top of everything. And there's nothing wrong with those foods, but they shouldn't be your whole diet. As good as they are, you need to have a wide variety of foods in your diet. And the beauty of, you know, testing and tracking these numbers is that once you get yourself into ketosis, once you get your weight where you want it, you see all the benefits, then I like the idea of really adding high-quality carbohydrates. And when I say high-quality carbohydrates, what I'm really talking about are vegetables. I don't think mm-hmm. we should be grains, period. Beans, you could add back in. Be careful with those. Sweet potatoes, things like that. And those are all good foods. Vegetables are excellent. There's lots of reasons we should be eating them. And add them back in until you find your level. For me, it's about 60 grams of carbs a day, and I make sure I get, you know, 90% of those grams come from vegetables. And when I eat that way, big salads, lots of, you know, sauteed and steamed vegetables, I feel better. It keeps me at the very, very bottom edge of ketosis. And if I want to, I could cut that number down and I could lose more weight. But I think it's really about finding your balance and then eating as many of the healthy foods as you can. Recently, I just started adding, you know, almost a cup of berries back in every night. So I think if I were to check my, you know, carbohydrate numbers now and track it, I might be up into that 70 to 80 range. And I'm going to see, will that, you know, knock me out of ketosis? I've been doing it about a week. I'm still right at the bottom range. And I know that those are good, healthy foods. You know, eating berries, there's a lot of reasons we should eat them. And so that's kind of what I've been doing. Over time, adding some of these real, you know, nutrient-dense foods back in, but keeping that balance to where I still feel good and I'm not gaining weight.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, and it's just a matter of patience and listening to your body. And I do the same. I use the berries because I was finding that the extreme low carb, because I'm still in the losing weight stage, wasn't helping my track workouts at all. I was dying. And so it was kind of fun then to try berries next time, you know, get some of the good carbohydrates, the good sugars in, and see how that works. And it was much better. So It's, you know, it's just a really cool thing to do and to try and work and see what works best for each of us.
Yeah, you know, one of the other issues that I want to address, and then we'll get to some calls. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this right now, but one of the common surgeries in our society today, and it's a shame, is gallbladder removal. You know, and any little problem with the gallbladder, and many doctors, their first response is, well, just take it out. In fact, I think a lot of people believe we must not need it, because they just seem to take them out. They don't really try to solve the problem or figure out why something was going wrong. Just take it out and be done with it. The problem is the gallbladder is extremely important to our health. And most people just don't know this. Your liver produces bile salts. Bile salts are there to digest fat. Fat, as we know, is a very important part of our diet. But there are two steps to getting the right fats. One, you have to eat them. You have to consume them. And two, you have to be able to digest them. Now, even people with a gallbladder might not be properly digesting their fats. I'm one of them. I was shocked. I didn't think, you know, I really had anything going wrong, but it turns out I did some, you know, pretty in-depth testing, and I'm eating enough fat, I'm not digesting it all. So I'm still coming up a little short on essential fatty acids, which shocked me. But there's a fairly simple way to fix it. There are some supplements that target the gallbladder. You can add bile salts to a meal so that when you eat it, you know you're getting your fats digested. And the interesting thing is it's kind of a loop. Part of the reason your gallbladder isn't working correctly is because you're not getting the fat-soluble nutrients that you need for your gallbladder to work right. The reason you're not getting them is because your gallbladder is not working right. So it almost seems like a catch-22, but we can supplement and support the gallbladder and take the bile salts to help digest the fats in our foods, which will give us all the cofactors we need. Once we do that, then our own gallbladder will start working properly, and over time we'll be able to discontinue the supplements. I like that idea. I don't like the idea of taking something the rest of my life. The problem
is
gallbladder's gone. You're going to be taking supplements the rest of your life. There's no way around it. Your gallbladder is a control mechanism for those bile salts. Your liver produces them. The gallbladder stores them, senses when there's fat that needs to be digested, and releases the proper amount of bile salts. Without it, your liver will keep producing bile salts, but they just drip steadily into your digestive tract. It doesn't work well. If you eat a high-fat meal, there's not enough bile salt. And if you don't eat enough fat all the time, the bile salts are irritating and disrupting the rest of your digestion. And these people aren't getting their fat-soluble nutrients, vitamins, cofactors, and then they see all kinds of other health-related problems. But the medical community doesn't make the connection. They take out the gallbladder. Now we're not digesting fats and getting all the nutrients we need. It causes other problems, and then they usually just give us some other drug to cover up the other problems. When what we really need to do is support the digestion of fats. If you have a gallbladder, it's not functioning properly, there are lots of ways to get it to work better. If you don't have one, you need to work with a nutritionist who understands how to supplement with meals so that you get proper digestion of the fats.
Yeah, that can be overwhelming. I think you've shared that before. So those of our community that without the gallbladder and wanting to, you know, follow the higher fat diet, what is their next step for them to do?
The real, you know, and this is going to become my next step for almost everybody. We have a really limited platform here. We have, you know, an hour, sometimes 2 hours a week.
Right.
A lot of questions. And we're not dealing with people in person. So we can give a lot of general advice. We can answer a lot of questions. We can point somebody in the right direction. But after being in this nutritional therapy program that I'm in, I am really blown away. I am much more impressed with this whole process than I thought I was going to be. And I am really highly recommending that anybody who wants to be healthier, anybody who's interested in this, find an NTP, a nutritional therapy practitioner. You can go to the website, nutritionaltherapy.com. And Kim, can we get this posted up on the website? I think we may have already done it, but
yeah,
you know,
we can bring it forward. Yeah.
Yeah, bring it up. And you can look for an NTP in your area. Now, NTPs are not doctors. They are nutritional therapists. They don't diagnose and they don't prescribe. They evaluate what might be going on with your body and your diet and your health very thoroughly. And then they will recommend food and lifestyle changes and possibly some supplementation to correct what's going wrong. So let me get to a break. We'll come right back, and we're also going to get to your calls and questions right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back to Destination Health. I'm Kevin Rutherford. My co-host is Kim Cockeram. Kim, I can't believe it. The time goes so fast on the show. I had some other things, but I think we should probably get to some phone calls. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, Kevin.
Let's do that. Let's start off in Ohio. Ken, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How are you guys doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good.
Well, number one, since you brought that up, at the CMC, are you going to be doing any of the make your thesis out and use us as test subjects for your thesis for your health part?
It's a great question. It's certainly been talked about, and Lisa just sent me a text message saying yes, so I guess I am.
Okay. I will be your first guinea pig then.
Got it.
With pleasure.
So here's just to kind of give everybody an idea of how this works, I don't want to scare anybody away, but there's some paperwork because this is a pretty in-depth evaluation. So once we set this up, decide how many we can do, get some people who want to do it, we'll start a list. There's a 3-day food journal that needs to be kept where you write down everything you eat and drink, anything that passes your lips. There's a form that goes through all the different systems of your body and ask you questions about symptoms and things like that, and then a health history thing. And I spend about an hour, because I've done some already, and I really like this whole process. I spend about an hour and a half on that paperwork before I ever see somebody. And then the first step is an interview where I go through all the concerns and that kind of stuff, and then the functional evaluation, and then some supplement testing to see what's going to work, and then the recommendations on what you do. So that's kind of how the whole process will work.
Sounds great. I'd be first on your list for you.
All right.
But my actual question, I have been on a ketogenic diet since July. Didn't get on it for this reason, but I'm also on a CPAP machine. Can't stand it. Ever since I've been on it, it's been the worst sleep that I've ever had. And I've lost 60 pounds from 250 down to my goal weight of 190. And I basically have maintained that now for the past 3 months.
Excellent. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm trying to do, because I'm going to go through NASDAQ, and they do a home, you know, where you can actually do the testing at home. What
right.
I'm looking to see, is there a, because I might have a sinus problem, which causes me to breathe through my mouth more than my nose.
Okay.
And in sleeping, that's basically what causes that sleep apnea aspect. Is
right.
there something that will relax more to where it will not necessarily fool the test, but relax me to get through and not have as many episodes?
Yeah, there are some things you can do. And what I would recommend is that you play around with them now. And try to determine what works better for you. There are some appliances that you can put in your mouth. You could talk to dentists, usually can do these. There are some you can buy, I think, on your own, but I would probably recommend working with a dentist that has some experience in this, that just holds your jaw in a little different position so that when you do breathe through your mouth, the airway stays open. That's one of the options. You might also want to try Breathe Right strips that open up your nostrils a little further, and that may just allow enough air through the nostrils that it'll help. So I think what it's going to be is trying some fairly minor things and tweaks here and there to see what works. There are surgeries. I am never a big fan of surgery. So I would try some of these appliances, maybe some Breathe Right strips. Maybe I've heard people say even different pillows, you know, can make a difference. So I would play around with some of those things. You can look up, there are some herbs that help this a little bit, and you could, you know, do a Google search and find some of those. And I would play around with some of these things because there's no downside to any of them.
Right. Well, now the other question, the other aspect that I hate drugs. I don't even take aspirin. Okay. That's
okay.
One of the reasons why I love the ketogenic diet, because it's all natural.
Good.
How about doing something like a ZQL for that one particular night, if it relaxes you enough to, will that help or will that hurt more?
You know, that's what you're going to have to play around with. There is a chance that something that really relaxes you actually makes the problem worse.
Right.
Sometimes I wasn't sure. Yeah, sometimes it's that total relaxation of your jaw and facial muscles that actually allows the airway to close off. But I would play around
right.
with it. I would try. There isn't, you know, a tremendous amount of research on any of this stuff, but I think you have a really good chance of getting off of this requirement, and I would play around with some of those ideas. Let's go to...
Kevin, real quick. Having to do with Ken, I might have missed this because he was on the CPAP right before losing the weight.
Yes.
I just wondered, and was that just for, sleep apnea and not getting enough oxygen? I just wondered if he has been retested since... losing the weight.
No, he wants to retest, but this is a problem in the industry, is that if they
mm-hmm.
identify that you have sleep apnea, they can make the CPAP machine required.
Required, and okay.
What he's hoping to do is pass the test and not be required. So he's trying to figure out what kind of things may help, even if it's a one-time thing, just to get him past this test.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I've talked about this. We could do a whole show about this. The requirement for CPAP in the trucking industry is a big money grab.
Mm-hmm.
It's being
yeah.
pushed by the companies that provide the machines and the testing. And if they can make it mandatory, they stand to make, you know, millions of dollars.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I was curious.
Yeah.
Maybe we can get some stuff posted to help, too. Okay, great, thanks.
Yeah, let's head to West Virginia. Craig, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Kim. Kevin, I had heart surgery, bypass surgery, in 2002, and the last 5 years I've made a real effort to change my diet. I exercise, and every time I go into my cardiologist, I get from him that all my numbers look great, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. And every time I ask to get off of medication someone, and he every time tells me, no, you'll be on these medications the rest of your life. And what I'd like to do, in the end of January, I take my DOT physical, and after I get cleared of that, I'd like to get on the ketogenic diet. I've lost 35 pounds, but I'm having trouble getting the last 20 pounds off. And I guess my questions are, do you think if I got on that diet, I can get off medication? And how would you recommend I find a doctor that will work with me to do this?
What medications are you on?
I'm on Prevostatin, which is a statin, Metoprolol, and the other one is Amlodipine, I believe.
Okay. So the statin would be the first one I would want to see you get off. Why are you on it? What was the doctor's reason? Have you had a heart attack?
No, I never had a heart attack. I had bypass heart surgery in 2002. I had a stress test. They told me that I had 5 blockages, but I had to be in pain. I had no pain, no symptoms. They did the surgery, and I've had, and ever since, I've just exercised, ate better, and I've never had any problems. So he told me that I have to stay on cholesterol medicine, I have to stay on blood pressure medicine, and I believe the other one's to keep your heart from beating too fast.
Yeah. Now, in that one, you're going to need to work with a doctor on that. The statin, I've done a ton of research on statins. There are a couple great books out there that I would highly recommend you go read. One is called The Great Cholesterol Con.
Okay.
There's another book in a, it's called Statins, Thieves of Memory. Or something close to that. It's by a guy named Dwayne Graveline.
Okay.
He's actually a NASA surgeon. A really amazing story. He was put on statins by his doctor. He didn't want to do it because he kind of knew better, but he went on them anyway, and he had horrible reactions. Like, ended up in the emergency room with total amnesia. And
mm-hmm.
Then he finally went and did the research himself and figured out it was the statins causing it. He's written some really good books about statins. So let me get to a break. I've got more for you, though, so stick around. We'll get to it right after this. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back to Destination Health. I'm Kevin Rutherford. My co-host is Kim Cockerham. Kim, we're going to get back to that call, but I know one of the things he's looking for is a recommendation on a doctor that can work with any of these kind of out of the ordinary diets, whether we call them ketogenic, low carb, high fat, paleo. They all have a lot of similarities, and most doctors just really don't understand them very well. Do we still have those links for the to look up paleo and ketogenic doctors?
I just posted the low-carb doctors to the Destination Health one, and I can go track down the paleo one. It's the one from Jimmy Moore's site, so I'm not sure if it's the same list or...
Yeah, they're actually...
No, there's Paleo Physician Network. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, there you go. Let's get some of those up, because I know that's one of the things that Craig was looking for. So,
mm-hmm.
Craig, I do believe that you can get off most, if not all, of these medications with a proper diet. So I would recommend two things. One, because you have some medical conditions and you are currently on medication, I do want you to work with a medical doctor, but I do want you to find one that understands this lifestyle. And the list is growing. We'll get that link posted up on our Destination Health Facebook page. But I'd also highly recommend that you seek out an NTP, a nutritional therapy practitioner, and they'll work together with the doctor. You know, they're not going to fight. They're going to handle the nutrition side, the supplement side, and you'll have your doctor, and he'll get this so they can work through the medication side. And I'm confident you can get off most, if not all, of these drugs.
Okay. And the last thing was the 20 pounds. It seems like I've hit a wall, and I just can't get that last 20 pounds off. I lost 35.
A fully ketogenic diet will probably knock those 20 pounds off in 2 to 3 months, if not much faster than that.
Okay, well, great. I appreciate it, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to New York City. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Good.
Hey,
what's
John.
Up?
Well, I have a question and then a comment. My question is, when you're using the terminology bile salt, is that B-I-L-E salt?
Yes.
Not
yeah.
B-I-O. Okay. I just wanted to be clear because I wanted to do a little research myself because you've really intrigued me talking about that. And
yeah,
I wanted to make sure I was looking up the correct thing.
There's actually some fairly simple tests that you can do to determine whether or not you are deficient in fatty acids. And I thought I would have, you know, passed these with flying colors. And I'm kind of borderline. One of them is fairly simple. Use pH tape on your tongue. So,
oh, okay.
You know, for a lot of the people that remember when I was first doing the fermented vegetables, I was using the pH tape to tell whether or not we had gotten, you know, the fermentation process going because the pH should
right.
go way down. Same tape. You put it on your tongue, and based on the pH of your saliva, it can be an indicator of how well you're getting the fatty acids that you need. So some days I would be deficient on that one. Some days I could pass it. So it intrigued me to try some of the others. And there's a muscle test that you do, and fairly simple to do. And I thought, boy, I'll just blow right through this one. And I failed it a couple times in a row. And then there were some other tests that we can check certain spots in the body. And I have some indications that I'm not getting enough fatty acids.
Okay, well, thank you for that info. My comment, for caution to the wind and said, no, I've been really awesome since May. I lost a ton of weight. I felt really good. And I decided, you know, I'm going to just eat whatever I darn well please. I felt like such garbage when I did it. I'll never do that again.
Yeah.
I'll never do it again.
That's
See, since May, I've thought that I've been missing out on stuff. I've really lamented all these things that I haven't been able to eat that I really, really love. I don't think I'm going to ever get to that point again because I will acutely remember what I felt like when I ate those things.
You know, I think that's another reason, like I was saying earlier, I think it's another reason to let yourself go. Once in a while, eat whatever you want, but pay attention to what happens and remember what happens. And for me, I know what happens. If I eat too much sugar, if I eat too many carbs, the first thing that happens is I get incredibly thirsty and I have to drink so much, I get bloated and I can't ever seem to quench my thirst. And my energy levels drop. By the end of the day, I don't want to do anything anymore. And if you notice that and you pay attention to it, for me, it's the motivation not to do it anymore.
I think I ate so much sugar, I overloaded myself because my head actually started spinning.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I honestly think my body went into overload and said, "Oh my God, what is all this stuff? We used to remember what this stuff was."
Right.
Right. And I ate so much sugar, it just blew me out, and my head was spinning. And not for like an hour or two. We're talking like, 16, 17 hours. I felt like absolute garbage.
Yeah, it really, from when I kind of overdid, during the holidays, it really took me about 48 hours to feel right again, to get back to where, I felt really good. Kim, we're almost out of time. I'm going to jump to one more call here. Let's go to Mississippi. Thomas, welcome to the program. Thomas, are you there?
Whoops.
Uh-oh. Well, I'm going to put him back on hold. We'll come back to him in a minute. Kim, I wanted to talk about that because this is a common thing. Some people will listen to the conversation we just have about, eating some of these things during the holidays and feeling horrible. And they'll say, "Oh my God, then I don't want to do this. I don't want to go on that diet because then if I ever do eat something I shouldn't, I'm going to feel horrible." And there is some truth to that. But it's a very relative thing. What I mean by that is it only feels horrible now because I know what it feels like to feel really good because I'm eating a good, clean diet. What I describe as horrible now was just a pretty normal feeling for me the way I used to eat.
Yeah, and that is so true. And that's okay to get that. I love where John said that, at first he thought he was being deprived and that, and I think a lot of us have that feeling of what, we have to give up. But when you're feeling that good and you experience that bad, it makes the good even better. So it just gives you more motivation to do the best you can when you can.
Yep. Hey, we got a call. We're going to squeeze in here. JW in Arizona. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. JW checking in. Happy New Year to all you guys. Have you had a chance to check out Dr. Joe yet? And I'd like some feedback on him if you could.
I have, and I like a lot of his stuff. I really do. I think, again, it comes down to I agree with 90%+ of everything he says. I think where we differ is on the saturated fat and some of the animal products that I believe provide a ton of nutrition, especially if we source them right and eat good, clean, pastured animals. But it's really impossible to argue with anything that he says. It's really good stuff that is the same kind of thing the NTP program pushes, which kind of the motto, and it fits really well with what he talks about, of NTP is you eat a diet of properly prepared, nutrient-dense whole food. And that's really a lot of what he talks about, and how could you possibly go wrong with that?
Well, he has a wealth of information on his website there with his radio programs and all those forms and papers that you're talking about filling out. You can download it from his website and just a wealth of information. I just can't get enough of it. So, but he's got 30-plus years. He's a BS in clinical nutrition. He's just a great guy to listen to, so. I just thought I'd, check in. I'm trying to figure out. I haven't found one fault with him yet. So I wondered your opinion.
Yeah, I didn't either. I haven't listened to much of the show just because I haven't had time, but I've read a lot of the resources, and he has some great stuff available.
Yeah, it helps. It helps somebody that like me that's hungry for an understanding of all this stuff. I don't have the time to go and go through an NTP course or whatever, but he explains it in plain English to where we can understand it. So,
absolutely. Great stuff. Got to cut you loose. We are all out of time. Kim, any final words?
No, just keep hanging with us, guys. If you're in that holiday, not feeling good type thing, let's look forward to 2016 and being the healthy people we can be.
Absolutely. Great stuff. Thanks, Kim. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.